NA World Services work right away, and I resigned in 1982. After a series of things happened, I just decided, you know, I didn't want to be a part of it anymore. So I not only resigned from service, but I moved out of California and came out east. And I've been very happy, and I've stayed clean ever since. And so I really am not that, I have not stayed active with World Services since 1982. I hear stories and I hear things, and it's changed so much that it's overwhelming at times to get a clear understanding of what's going on anymore. But so I it would be nice to see it all come together and make sense again. What I've done, or what I did a few months ago, was I put together as much as I could a history of NA from Jimmy's notes and tapes. I was a very good friend of Jimmy's, and I also spoke with his wife and some of his other friends, and I put together a history. It's not complete, but I think I'd like to share it with you because I think it might give you a picture of how NA, what NA used to be like, and you'll see for yourself how much it's grown and how far we've come. You know, about a month ago I was asked to go up to Massachusetts to give an NA history, a big NA history function they had. And it was really pretty funny. my girlfriend and I flew up there, and the flight was about 45 minutes, and we drove around in this addict's car for about 3.5 hours. He was trying to track down his ex-wife and his kids, and at one point we had 3 addicts in the car, 3 children, and 2 cats. And it was really wild because that night, in a room about this big, it was a history workshop on the region, the area up there, and then the history of NA. And I was last. And, you know, I had all this wonderful information, and I had all these archival knickknacks, you know, and I invited people to come and look at them, and the only question that anybody had was, who gets the credit for starting the first meeting in their area? That's all they cared about. And during the dance, what happened was, as I was shuffling all my papers together and going back to my seat, I dropped one of my original copies of the our first pamphlet on the floor. And I didn't know it. And in the middle of the dance, on a crowded dance floor, some girl came up to me and she goes, "Hey, is this yours?" So, you know, it was an experience for me, you know, but I really didn't, it was kind of wild because I felt like maybe people weren't ready to hear it, and I don't think, it was just like being in the Twilight Zone, but it's good to be in a room where people are familiar with some of the issues anyway. So what I'll do is, because I wasn't here in 1953, I mean, I was born in 54, I had to write this down, so I want to be as thorough as I can with the information that I have. Betty, Jimmy's wife, has invited me to come out and sort through file cabinets of stuff that she has this summer, and I hope to get out there and help her with it. So... Do you guys want to hear this? Okay. And then when I finally get into NA, I can sort of ad-lib it a little bit. Okay. prior to August of 1953 and before Narcotics Anonymous as we know it came into existence, there were organizations and groups throughout the United States who were trying to do something for drug addicts. Many of you might have heard about some of these groups. Programs in Louisville, Kentucky, and New York City were started by concerned citizens, prison officials, Salvation Army volunteers, and even drug addicts. Some of these groups adopted the 12 steps of AA, and some made variations to the 12 steps and inserted new language of their own. However, these groups and organizations bear little, if any, resemblance to the structure and meaning of the Narcotics Anonymous we have all come to know. During the 50s, in the Southern California area, groups known as HFD groups, habit-forming drugs, were scattered throughout, and there was a group who called themselves Addicts Anonymous. However, these groups eventually died out for many reasons. Two reasons in particular were that they did not abide by the 12 traditions that AA was using, or they were considered to be run like a one-man show. The NA in New York City that started up in the 50s published a pamphlet for drug addicts entitled Our Way of Life, An Introduction to NA. This pamphlet was printed at the Rikers Island Print Shop, and in this pamphlet there's an excerpt that reads, "The National Advisory Council on Narcotics, Inc., a group of civic-minded citizens sincerely interested in this problem, functions as the Board of Directors for Narcotics Anonymous. The function of the board is to direct, guide, and coordinate Narcotics Anonymous groups." Obviously, this was not the birth of NA as we know it. If you call the World Service office today and ask who Jimmy Kennan was, you'll be told that he was a nice man who helped NA a lot. But the truth is, our history begins with him. For years, he was the first and sometimes only NA voice many addicts all over the world heard. He could touch people and give them hope that they never had before. There was something very magical about the way Jimmy carried the message. When people got close to him, their natural inclination was to recover. Jimmy Kennan was 3 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and very involved in what is still known as the Radford Clubhouse of AA in Studio City, California. He was on their board of directors and was very involved with service work for AA. Jimmy by trade was a roofer and very often did roofing work for the clubhouse. Jimmy and other AA members would go down to Skid Row to 12-step the alcoholics. When they were doing work with addicts, however, they observed that addicts were not identifying with what they were talking about. Jimmy was quoted as saying that one kid in particular told him, "I just can't buy this stuff. I'm not an alcoholic." Others felt the same way. The people Jimmy made friends with were addicts like himself, and so many of his friends were dying. Jimmy and his fellow 12-step callers knew that the addicts they were trying to help weren't making it. He knew that there must be a way of adapting the steps to other specific causes. He heard about a guy named Danny Carlson who ran a program, but his program wasn't the same. They were not anonymous, and they admitted they had problems with hardcore drugs. He thought then that there should be meetings for addicts because addicts were still dying despite AA's message of recovery. Jimmy had learned that AA could not do all things for all people, and that most importantly, the 12 traditions had to be adhered to. A committee was formed in June or July of 1952. Jimmy and four other people met at a member's house and tossed the idea around. However, the committee eventually died out. In June or July of 53, a committee formed and met every couple of weeks to try to formulate what they were going to do. There was a commitment to get something going. They decided that they wanted to follow a format like AA's because AA was a winner, but it wasn't working for addicts. Jimmy was elected chairman of the committee, and they immediately voted down two things he suggested, one being that the group not use the AA name, and two being to adapt AA's 12 traditions. One of the first things that occurred was naturally an argument. An argument over what we were going to call ourselves. It was agreed that it would have to specify addiction and not one particular drug. Drugs Anonymous didn't sound right because we wanted a program called DA, yet narcotics was more understood. We couldn't call ourselves Addicts Anonymous because that would infringe on the AA name. The committee wanted to call it AA/NA. Jimmy informed the group that they could not call themselves this as it infringed on the AA name. Yet the group decided that that was what they wanted to be called. Jimmy knew that at least they were off to a good start with performing in a group conscience-like manner. Doris called AA headquarters in New York, and AA informed them that they could not call themselves AA/NA as it implied affiliation with AA. Narcanon was another suggestion, but that was something Dianetics, the Scientology thing, called themselves. Eventually, the name Narcotics Anonymous was agreed upon. On August 17, 1953, the bylaws were drawn up outlining what Narcotics Anonymous should be about. The first paragraph of those bylaws stated, 1. This society or movement shall be known as Narcotics Anonymous, and the name may be used by any group which follows the 12 steps and 12 traditions of Narcotics Anonymous. The first meetings of NA were held at members' homes. One of the members, Scott K., had a meeting at his house on Chandler Boulevard in North Hollywood, California. Eventually, booklets that were printed up were kept in Scott's garage in back of his home. Some of you may have seen that floating around. I have a copy up here if you'd like to see it. The first established NA meeting was at a church at the corner of Clybourne Street and Kintara Street in Sun Valley, California. It was held every Monday night and was referred to as the Dad's Club and run by the Salvation Army. A handmade sign with the letters NA was placed outside the church. Jimmy would stand outside by the front door. Cars would slowly creep by and then tear down the street. It was obvious that outsiders weren't quite sure if the church was staked out. At that time, Jimmy approached the police department and informed them that of their intentions to meet. Because back in those days, it was a felony to just be an addict, up until really pretty recently. In the 70s, I know it was still a felony. At that time, the police department assured Jimmy that there would be no surveillance at any of the NA meetings. A small electric stove was purchased to make coffee. Back then, no one had any money, and mugs were schlepped from meeting to meeting because there was no money to purchase paper cups. Jimmy and another member would go to the jails and institutions to carry the message of NA. Later, however, that member thought it would be okay to charge people a fee for lecture services. Jimmy said that was unacceptable and could not be done. That member eventually went back to AA. Because NA was so new, many people were struggling for power and saw themselves as leaders. The meeting moved to a location on Stagg Street. A lady named Doris was part of the original committee, and Frank and Doris had a machine shop inside their home. Barbara, Tommy, and Paul were also names of members of the original group. Doris typed the formation of the first meeting minutes. The meeting stayed at a church for about 6 months, and then it was moved to a place known as Schreier's Dryer in North Hollywood. This was in 1954, 55, and 56. The building was originally the North Hollywood Lodge and Sanitarium, and the owner was a man named Dr. Schreier. AA meetings had been meeting there since 51 or 52. Dr. Schreier gave permission to NA to hold a meeting there once a week. There was a small parking lot there, but only 5 to 6 people could fit there comfortably at one time. There was some conflict with the traditions at that time, and Jimmy did not attend any meetings there. Meetings were held there for quite some time. Then Schreier's Dryer was to undergo some remodeling, and the meeting moved to another sanitarium. I guess those were the only places that wanted us, on Ventura Boulevard in Studio City. When the remodeling was completed at Schreier's Dryer, the meeting moved back to that site. By 1954, there were 12 to 15 people attending the meetings, and by 1955, the number went up to 18 to 20. There was always talk of starting up more meetings. Most people went to one AA meeting a week and then to AA and other therapeutic groups. Society in general did not really believe that addicts could stay drug-free. However, the word addict was not a dirty word anymore, and more was being done in society to help addicts. 12-step work was done in groups because people didn't want to go alone on a 12-step call because they thought they were going to use. Recovery was getting a little easier since more addicts were working. So by this time, those were the only two NA meetings in the world, Schreier's Dryer and the Sanitarium on Ventura Boulevard. In 1958, what was to be known as the Mother Group was started at the Unity Church on Moore Park Street in Studio City. The group eventually was known as the Architects of Adversity Group, a fifth and tenth step meeting. Another meeting sprung up at Magnolia Boulevard behind a store. There was a small apartment where a member named Bill W., no relation to Wilson, lived. Eight members met there for a brief period of time. They'd sit around on the bed or on the floor. By 1959, NA had folded. People had either died, gone back out, or went back to AA. Additionally, groups were not abiding to the traditions. One night, Jimmy Kay and Sylvia Wexworth were sitting at the kitchen table again and wondering what to do because no one was coming to the meetings. Jimmy and Sylvia were the only two left. In tears, Sylvia said, "What are we going to do?" And Jimmy looked at her and said, "I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm going to start over again, and this time we're going to start living by the traditions." In the beginning of 1960, with about four members, NA started up again. In the mid-60s, a meeting was held at a duplex apartment that Jimmy's brother rented out near the corner of, in Studio City. Regular members of that group were Jimmy, Pepe, Scott, Doris, and Danny. In 1961, Penny Kay, author of I Can't Do Any More Time in Our Little White Book, came into NA and eventually held a meeting in her home in North Hollywood. Jimmy's home was the first hotline to helping addicts in a small room which was originally his roofing and painting office. In the mid-60s, Jimmy put together NA's first pamphlet, an 8-page pamphlet for distribution. Jimmy heard that there was an NA group in New York. This group was contacted, but even though they called themselves Narcotics Anonymous, they were into a different sort of thing. Although they had the same name, they did not fashion themselves after Alcoholics Anonymous. They accepted donations and funds from the government, and they openly admitted that they were not like us. They informed the group in Sun Valley that they did not wish to join our club. They wanted to be a separate entity. The first board of trustees was formed in 68. The first board of trustees was formed in 1968. Chuck S. was the first member of the board after Jimmy alone held the position since NA's beginning. The first World Service office was set up at a place called the Crenshaw House in L.A. However, two organizations were now operating under one roof, and the work was not getting done. The World Service Office was then moved to the headquarters of the Suicide Prevention Center, but the two programs were getting mixed up, and confusion arose. The literature was not getting mailed out, and there was lots of theft. There was no consistency. The office then moved above a bail bonds office on Van Nuys Boulevard in San Fernando Valley. In order to work in the office, someone would have to run down every half hour and put money in the parking meters. The rent could not be met. It was at this time that Jimmy Kay moved the World Service Office to his home in Sun Valley. Up to that point, the World Service Office consisted of one tiny box of records, one beat-up couch, and one filing cabinet. The borrowed desk had to be returned. He answered the phones day and night and took care of the mail. The few people who had volunteered were expected to work. And everyone was motivated by him. The office acquired a used typewriter, used file cabinets, and other outdated office equipment like scales, staplers, etc. Jimmy and his wife, Betty, would go out to yard sales and go through trash dumpsters for things they could use at the office. Cardboard boxes were collected from behind stores to use for shipping. Paper bags were cut up and used for wrapping literature and tape. The percentage of the working volunteers at the office were newcomers. Every penny was put back into the office. Now, understanding that our organization started in 1953, it was sad to admit that in 1972 there were still just a few meetings around the world. That is not a lot of growth for any organization. For the first time, though, there was some stability and consistency for NA through the World Service Office. In 1960, Jimmy Kennan wrote Who is an Addict? In 1960, Jimmy K. wrote What is the Narcotics Anonymous Program? In 1960, Jimmy K. and Sylvia W. wrote Why Are We Here? The second half of How It Works in our NA pamphlet, beginning with This Sounds Like a Big Order, was written by Jimmy K. In 1960, Jimmy K. wrote Recovery and Relapse. In 1961, Jimmy K. wrote We Do Recover. Jimmy K. also wrote Another Look, which was later revised by him in 1983. In 1962, Phil P. wrote One Third of My Life. In 1962, Penny K. wrote I Can't Do Any More Time. In 1962, Gene H. wrote Vicious Circle. In 1962, Bob B. wrote Something Meaningful. In 1976, Greg P. wrote I Was Different. In 1976, Betty K. wrote Fearful Mother. In 1976, Bill B. wrote Fat Addict. Our prayer, My Gratitude Speaks When I Care and When I Share the NA Way, was written by Jimmy K. Our symbol was designed by Greg P. and Jimmy K. There's a real touching story behind our NA symbol. Jimmy was in the hospital with TB, and it was there in his hospital bed that he carved what is our symbol into a piece of leather. It had a gold background, and it was carved very deep. It was a circle with a diamond in the center with NA inscribed in the middle. Prior to world conventions, NA had what was known as anniversary dinners. A tape is available of the 20th anniversary dinner of NA where Jimmy K. and Jack Whaley, who was then the chairman of the Board of Trustees, spoke. Back then, everyone went to both fellowships, NA and AA. The significance of this tape, however, is the revolutionary idea that addicts could recover in Narcotics Anonymous and that NA was separate and apart from AA. At the 6th World Convention of NA held in Ventura, California, the first World Conference was held. You know, that may not be right. I guess it was 1976. So what year was the Ventura? Okay. Oh, well, the 6th. Well, something was held in conjunction with the World Convention. Okay. That conference established an ad hoc committee of elected representatives of the fellowship to review and revise the service structure that had been proposed for NA called the NA Tree. The NA Tree was NA's first service structure, which was devised by Greg. That ad hoc committee presented the results of its labors to NA's first independent World Service Conference held in Van Nuys, California in the spring of 78. The conference accepted that work and the many other suggestions that came in and turned them all over to the newly established World Service Conference Literature Committee for finalization. The service manual of Narcotics Anonymous was presented to the conference in the spring of 79 for approval. I was 30 days clean in 1978 when I first met with Jimmy K. at his home. I was taken back by his strength and devotion toward NA. Jimmy always used to say that you may not become a spiritual giant in NA, and you may never come out with more than 5 cents in your pocket, but you will learn how to think for yourself. If you made a commitment to NA, you would learn how to stand up on your own 2 feet and think for yourself. Most of all, Jimmy loved freedom, and if you listen to the tapes that he spoke, he always talked about freedom in such an inspiring way. As I said earlier, very early on in our history, people were vying for power, but no one really wanted to work. Even in good old California, where it all started, personalities shaped areas and regions. Southern California and Northern California could never agree on anything. The San Fernando Valley and the Bay Area not being San Francisco, but it's like a beach community like Santa Monica, Manhattan Beach, all around inside of LA, were always squabbling about one thing or another. cliques would form, people who were still unrecovering, thinking they knew something. In 1976, at the World Convention in San Francisco, California, a very funny thing happened. World conventions were always held in California because where else were they going to be held? And so every year it was the same thing, you know, at any world convention. You'd have Northern California getting up to the... Oh, and back then, how they determined where the next World Service Conference was going to be is they'd all sit in the room on Sunday in this big auditorium, and they'd vote by hand where it was going to be. So that's how you would know where it was going to be next year. So Northern and Southern California were the only two who ever had a bid to propose to the convention floor. And they would give these fancy-schmancy proposals, you know, the Holiday Inn, filet mignon, you know, and all this. And then Southern California would get up with another fancy proposal, you know. So this is the way it would go. And in 1976, out of the blue, this young girl from Houston, Texas, gets up to the mic, and she said, well, I don't have a proposal, but we really need y'all in Texas. And it was so weird, man, because you had, like, what the chairman decided to do was, okay, everybody from Northern California get on this side of the room, everybody from Southern California get on that side of the room, and everybody from Texas stand right in the middle. So there were a lot of members who really didn't give a shit, you know, where it was going to be, but they were moved by this girl from Texas because she had nothing. All she talked from her heart, you know. But Northern and Southern California, you know, God forbid if you take it out of California, that's the end. So the room split up. Northern and California were pretty matched, 50-50, but there were more people for Texas down the middle. And then what happened after that was so hilarious. They started screaming at one another, right? Come on, what are you doing? We got to stay in California. Come on, Northern California. And then Southern California, and then Northern California would say, yeah, right, well, you come over here. You know, it's like they didn't want to budge. And even this one dear friend of mine, Danny, who is this biker with long hair, Chicano guy, he had a lot of time in the program. He stood up on a table and he was going, Chicano's over here, you know. It was like a madhouse. And because of their refusal to budge and come together, because some people were screaming, let's just keep it in California. If we unite, we can stay in California. Well, because of their refusal to, compromise, Houston got it. And you should have seen the stunned looks on everybody's face, you know, even mine. I was like, oh, my God. And so anyway, it was a good thing, though, because wherever the World Convention went after that, NA tripled. I mean, the conventions would bring, after the convention was over, dozens, hundreds of meetings would start in cities, and that's pretty much been the way what happens when a convention, a world convention, comes to a city. Maybe now I think what happens when a convention goes to a city is that there's this recommitment and or a desire to commit to Narcotics Anonymous. I've seen that happen. So NA grew and grew. Many people called Jimmy a rebel. He never had a problem with saying, no, that's wrong, we can't do that, it isn't right. He never believed that any one group or person should run NA, and he was not afraid to tell anyone who came along with some good-smelling horseshit that that was what it was. So needless to say, he made some enemies along the way. While we were all squabbling about our major differences on an area level in the San Fernando Valley, Jimmy reached out to members all over the world, in Canada, Australia, Germany, Guam, Great Britain, Scotland, and Ireland. Jimmy's son, who was stationed in Germany, provided literature to the army bases there, and through his connections as an officer, had literature sent to forces in Vietnam. One of my most memorable moments when I worked at the World Service Office was the day we got a letter from New York City from Terry. And it was the happiest day because you know, as many addicts as there are in New York City, it was like one of the last cities to really get it together and happen. That was in 81. He made contact with new areas. Starter kits were sent out from the World Service Office, and he was there for people when they called and hoped to hear about NA as a program and how NA could help them or their area. Like I said, the World Service Office used to be in his house. A whole bunch of us would go over there on Tuesday and Thursday nights, and those were some of the nicest nights in my recovery. I was very new in recovery, but I felt such a part of, and it was an atmosphere of love and respect, because we were all working for nothing. And we were all doing it because it made us feel good. Jimmy had a modest little home. He collected books. He loved to read. There were knickknacks everywhere. And because Jimmy and his Betty collected them. He lived across the street from an airfield, and despite the noise and pollution, beautiful flowers and birds were always in his yard. I think you're going to be shown a tape tomorrow, and you'll get an idea of what his house looked like. There was the file cabinets and used typewriter were in the mud room. The literature was stored in a back room. The duping machine that we used to dupe tapes for the NA tape library was kept in the living room. It was really hard getting an NA tape back in those days because everybody was identifying as addict, alcoholic, and sober, and, you know. So, you know, we were always sort of like, you know, deleting the word or fixing it up a little, you know, because we wanted to get some good tapes out there to groups and areas outside of California who were really struggling to get started. But it was an atmosphere of being at ease and being yourself, and it was really growth for me because, like I said, I was new, and I got to be around people who had a lot of time and experience with the program, and I just felt I felt like I finally found some purpose and meaning in my life. Jimmy could talk until sunrise about this program. He loved to talk, and during those days, Jimmy's door was always open to addicts. It was a safe place to go. You could always hear about recovery in NA, and you always felt good when you left his house. I knew very early on in my recovery that I would never use again. And because I grew to love and appreciate Jimmy K, I grew to love and care about NA. I grew to care about NA because I first learned to love it. One of the times Jimmy was invited to share on a radio station call-in program about NA. A typical practicing addict who knew nothing about recovery, let alone NA, would call in with stupid questions like, can you mix green pills with black pills? And what's the most potent kind of pot out there? We were all sitting at home going, oh, shit, man. You know, here's a perfect time for, you know, NA to be talked about and get some of those addicts out there in, you know, because it was a rock and roll station. And so we said, hey, let's one of us call up, you know, and pretend we're just a dope fiend or something, an addict who wants to know about NA. So Doug called up. And he asked, well, what is addiction? Because Jimmy really knew how to talk about addiction. And can you explain what it is, he said. And dear Jimmy, passing over this opportune time, simply said, is that you, Doug? You should know better, you know. And so that was the sort of guy Jimmy was. He really didn't, you know, he wasn't, he didn't do things to try to impress people. You know, he did things, you know, very opposite that. Okay, in the late 70s, Greg P. and Bo S. began the efforts of what would later be known as NA's basic text. Our basic text was written by addicts for addicts. This project took over 6 years to complete. And our book finally became available to the fellowship, conference approved, in 82. In 1980, there were whisperings going on about a new and better World Service Office. At one time, there was a worldwide paper strike, and yet the fellowship clamored for their orders. While toilet paper in Japan was going for $10, addicts could not understand or conceive of the delays the office was experiencing. With very little funds to automate the office, working in the office was a night and day affair. As I stated before, most of the people involved with the actual work were newcomers because the people with time were still going to AA or were too busy doing other things. Yes, Jimmy was radical, all right. At the World Service Conference in 1980, it was the World Service Office that came out with the statement and motion that NA should cease and desist the selling and distributing or reading of AA literature at NA meetings. The first foreign translator and a trustee stood up and said, "Oh, I hoped it wouldn't come to this." The first foreign translation in Spanish of the NA pamphlet was prepared for distribution by the office and presented to the conference in 1981. The World Directory, typed by hand on an outdated and oftentimes broken typewriter, was typed and copied in Jimmy's house. It was presented at the World Service Conference for distribution to members. Around this time, there developed a conflict between the World Service Literature Committee and the World Service Office over who was going to be in charge of production and distribution of the basic text that was in the making. In the spring of 1981, just prior to the World Service Conference, the World Service Office moved its headquarters to a new office on Vineland Avenue in Sun Valley in the hopes of meeting the demands of officers of the conference and Board of Trustees to move the office out of Jimmy's house once and for all. The office was moved to its new location. It was one large room with a storefront. The trucks came to move the furniture and equipment out of Jimmy's house and into our new office. Jimmy was still the manager of the office and was looking forward to working at a location outside of his home. Yet I can't help but wonder how he must have felt that day. With the bigger office, we all felt so grateful and proud to have acquired such a place to better facilitate the needs of the fellowship. However, the move the office made to its new location, primarily to address the concerns of some of the officers of the World Service Conference and the entire Board of Trustees, did not finally address their real intentions, which were to disband the World Service Office Board, staff, and Jimmy Kennan as the office manager. Jimmy K. died of lung cancer on July 9, 1985, a little while after he was locked out of the World Service Office. Upon arriving to work one day, the locks had been changed. He went home and wept in Betty's arms. In all the moments and times I spent with Jimmy, he never told me what to do. I can remember when the controversy with the office started, I would get so upset and angry. I would tear down Vineland Avenue towards his house to get some answer I needed. And when I'd get to his house, he'd sit me down, give me some coffee, give me a cookie. And I'd expect some profound thing, remedy. But he'd just pull out a poetry book and, you know, read me a real peaceful poem, and it would calm me down. And you know, I'd be okay. I'd start to relax. Jimmy was not a director. He was not into control. He was not all-powerful, and he was not selfish. But Jimmy was not one to go along just to get along. Jimmy could vote with a blindfold on, standing up for what he believed was right and in NA's best interests always. And he was never the instrument of any one person's demise or misfortune in NA. He went by principle. I wish I could have had about 10 years when I met him so that I could ask him some real meaty questions about life and how it relates to the program for me today. But I think today he would be proud of me. I have a life. And I will always be grateful to him for when I met him at the beginning of my recovery. And that's what I have. Thanks. You applauded. More than Massachusetts. Does anybody have any questions? None?
I mean, all the switching around the wires and junk is like weird. Is that the non-controversial version of the things that went on there, or could we get you to expound a little bit about who did what to whom when? I mean, that's kind of what I thought maybe we were here for, and people like really poked me for stuff like names and stuff. Yeah, let's tell the story, hon.
I've heard a million versions.
I'd really like to know how he got taken out. Some said he was too senile, some said he was out. He was not senile by any means. He had an excellent memory. I was often shocked at how he could recall, because I used to work with him all the time, and you know, we'd get letters in from Poop Butt, South Dakota or something, and I would forget the name and when, what day it was sent, and he'd know it just like that. So he had a very keen and sharp mind. He was not senile. God. There was, like I said in the thing, when the basic text was being born, I think there might have been visions of what that might bring to NA, whether it be prophets or an explosion of growth, and perhaps people wanted to be in on that, maybe seeing themselves as managers, leaders, you know. This is what I'm trying to imagine. You know, I don't think people, I have to believe that people do not intentionally go out to stick it up somebody's ass, although there was a time in my recovery when I really thought that. But the way that it was gone about was disgraceful and dishonest. I sat there through three conferences, and you know, I felt like a witness to just an atrocity. You know, what I saw happening was a lot of new people in recovery with a couple of years clean being prompted with the motions to go up to the conference floor and make the motions that would get him out. The fellowship did not want Jimmy out. The trustees wanted a... was that when the book was finally getting ready... See, the office had to make sure that how the book was getting distributed was being done in the channels that we had at that time through the service structure. So it was a lot of confusion and a lot of, well, you know, like the book, whoever, the people that were involved with the basic text, it was their baby, you know, just like the office was our baby, you know, and it's very hard to let go of something. So I guess when it came time to producing and distributing the book, or letting go of the book and letting the office do its job, they were reluctant. Well, one of the things that happened was the printers that we had used forever, we gave them the money to print the basic text, and they went bankrupt. So that was a real blow. And, of course, it was, you know, some people didn't accept that those things happen. I remember one year at the conference, I sat there in a circle with some other committee members, and I was speaking on behalf of the World Service Office, and, you know, this one chairman at that time said, look, I just want to make sure that when this book comes, that people aren't living up in Beverly Hills and driving Mercedes. And, you know, he was implying that the World Service Office was the, he was assaulting the character of the people that worked in the office. And I remember really being hurt, and I just said, that's an insult for you to be speaking that way. The thought really never occurred to me that anyone in NA could be like that or could think that way. So it became like a battle, and maybe it was also a battle between East Coast and West Coast, or I don't know. I do know that, like I said, a lot of what I see happening is that very early on in our history, there were powerful personalities, and maybe they got snubbed. Maybe there was a fight, and they carried resentments. Later on, those people would sponsor people, and you know how that goes, you know. Oh, you're my sponsor. Well, this person's a motherfucker, and watch out for that asshole, and you know. So these resentments sort of like kept growing, and so the, you know, I have a story of a member here who wrote it really good. Maybe I'll read it tomorrow. His version of what he saw happening and how a lot of it's tied into personalities right out of Southern California. A lot of the people who went around talking about Jimmy never even met him. And in my personal experience, none of the trustees had the balls to confront the man himself and say, hey, here's my beef, you know. Can you just get out, you know, or why are you there? You know, they always used their little stoolies, their pigeons with 2 years, 1 year, 6 months, you know. And that was how that worked.
Then I'll plug in the other mic. I'm an addict named Lawrence, and I appreciate your, you know, your presentation and your effort. You know, to sort of educate us, you know, and give us some information. But I have to say it's so, and I just feel like this is trivializing Jimmy K. Because if we are to get to the bottom of our history, I just feel that, you know, we need to know exactly what happened, you know. What happened? I mean, who are the people who wanted Jimmy removed? You know, if we are to put and hope to put anything together, you know, as a history book or something like that, you know, it just seems to me that it would be advantageous for us to have, you know, who are these board of trustee members? I mean, you know, what was the power play? Because obviously there's power play involved. And, you know, I appreciate your efforts, and I don't mean to trivialize your efforts, because I really appreciate it, and it was informative. But, you know, I just think that, you know, this is basically, you know, a story of, you know, of Jimmy K, you know, and which is okay. But, you know, it just, I think there's a whole lot more there, and we're just not getting it. You know, I just feel like, you know, half full, you know. And my other question is, when New York approached you know, to bid for the World Convention, and that's another question I have. I mean what was actually the reason and the purpose for having the World Convention, you know? Because I realized there was a purpose at the beginning, And I'm just wondering why it seems today that we had just, like, totally prostituted ourselves in terms of that. I mean, and we're putting on flyers, and, I mean, we're endorsing all the kinds of stuff. You know, and then we're saying it's in the name of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, and I just, hopefully, maybe you can respond on that. I'd like to give you a hug.
Well, I only have my opinion I can offer here, but in answer to your second question, there are a lot of members who love conventions and look forward to going on a vacation every year where there's thousands and thousands of addicts from all over the world. It's exciting to a lot of people. Most new people who go to a world convention would most likely never use again. So, I don't know, some people like them, some people don't, you know. There's always been a great turnout, and I think it's about having fun. It's probably one of the few times where so many addicts can gather together and have fun instead of fighting and assaulting one another at a conference level. And in answer to your first question, hey, I can't distort the truth. History is history. It can't be modified, changed. It was a very simple history, our very early beginnings. And because Jimmy's name was so slandered and he was treated so disrespectfully and in such an uncaring way, I felt it necessary to give a truer and more honest picture, which you will probably never hear, to people, because it's important that you know who carried us for a long time and who made it possible for us to grow. Jimmy never wanted to take credit for being the big beginner or anything. That wasn't what he was about. But you know, I can read things. I can see what the truth is. I can come up here and look. And if you want to know who did what, they're all right here in the minutes. If you want to know who the entire board of trustees was, look in your 1979, your 1980 and 81 and even 82 minutes. The motions are in there. Some girl from, I don't know, Florida made the motion. Finally, someone had the guts to just come flat out and say that we just fire them, you know. And it took that long, you know. So, you know, I'm not about sitting here and giving a bunch of names out when those people aren't here. I was hoping I could come here today and see some of those people here. They're not here. Because I'd like to know, you know, I'm curious too, you know, how can you, who the man was your sponsor for 10 years, what happened, you know? So, you know, I have questions. Some of the very people that were responsible for the removal of Jimmy and caused him so much pain walk around and glorify him today, which totally blows me away. Taking credit for things like loving and what a dear man he was. So, you know, that kind of shit disturbs me. I don't understand that one. I hope the slander on the tape isn't...
I'm a grateful recovering addict, Yeshua by name. Two things. From what I understand, when a nation, a people, a family, a person cannot identify a trauma of his past, well, then it's subject to repeat it. This situation that happened with Jimmy K, okay, in one respect we can say that's the past. What I'm concerned about is the people who we have today, the leaders we have today, the innovators, the people who are producing literature for us now, who have NA at heart, what is to prevent the situation from happening to them now and next week or whatever. And the second part of my question is there a group of people or a panel or a committee or whatever that's coordinating your portion about history, Dave's portion about history, and other people's about the history of NA at this present time, at this particular meeting, and coordinating that and adding to that the artifacts to present to a publisher or whatever to print this history, and what is being done to protect the artifacts and pieces of history and documentation that Jimmy has, that his wife has, Betty Kay has, in case something happens to her. Is there some sort of mechanism to protect that information or to distribute that information or to coordinate all of this in at least a raw form of the basic history that we could look at or be printed or what?
Thanks a lot. Those are good questions. A few years ago, Lynn A., a dear friend of Betty's, approached Bob Stone at the World Service Office and said, look, Betty has tons and tons of our archival history about N.A. that he saved as his personal memorabilia that she's ready to turn over to Narcotics Anonymous under one condition, that it not be altered or changed. The reason she said this is because there was a time in our history where members of the conference wanted to change Jimmy's story, which was another look. Jimmy always felt that another look was part of his story, and it wasn't right to revise, delete, change, fix up anybody's story. He revised it himself. They were pretty, I think back then what they were hung up with was the word self-reliance, because that's a dirty word in AA, so they couldn't understand that the man with his over 20 years of recovery, found true self-reliance after having worked the steps, and as you and I, and as you and I well know, that the only way that we find true self-reliance, we all, if we're here that long, have developed a relationship with our higher power, and through reliance on a higher power, we come upon self-reliance. But they had to have that spelled out. You know, they thought, you can't just say you're going to be self-reliant, you know. So that was one of the issues. So she offered, that was her conditions, and without any further, I'll get back to you or anything, Bob Stone said, no, sorry, but anything that you turn over to the World Service Office becomes our property, and we can do anything with it that we choose. So she politely said, well, fuck you. So that's the story there. I find it very hard to believe that the World Service Office, the way it is now, would ever, ever in a million years give credit where credit is due. I think NA, the way it is now, the story they'd like to present to the fellowship is the one we have now, the poop butt one that says, hey, in 1953, one day we all woke up and here was this big fat fellowship for us all. That's not the way it happened. It had to start somewhere. And a lot of the people who are still involved with World Services, I don't know, maybe they still have resentments for them. I know at the time the World Service Office was functioning, there were some strong personalities on the staff. There were members of the Literature Committee that resented members of the World Service Office staff. And, hey, I was a member of the World Service Office staff, and I resented a lot of the members on the World Service Literature Committee. So there was that going on. So did that answer your question? Okay, I forgot the other one. Okay, well, I know that there's some history workshops being done. I know there's one in Alabama in August, and a lot of the people who were involved with the basic text, our original basic texts are going to be there. And they're trying to start the compiling of all this information. People who have any archives or information or about anything, about any history period in NA are being encouraged to come out and participate. And it's going to be, from what I understand, a very big event and a lot of participation. I know there's some tapes floating around, but you know, I don't know if the World Service Office would publish something like that. I think it would have to be, because we're such a we organization, you know, we put so much emphasis on the we, they would have to, I would think that in going along with that, they would have to cut that part out. That's the way I see a conference approved, or an office approved, or a board approved, or whoever's running the boat now, would probably do it, you know. Not by the World Service Office and the World Service Conference, no. Well, that was a question that was asked to me at the CMP region, and, you know, do something. You know, go to some of these history workshops, you know, get these, get the thing started. I don't know. I mean, you know, we can... I don't know. I don't know how something like that gets started. I guess it would be a lot like how we started our basic text. You know, an idea was planted and a bunch of people got in on it and it started to happen. You know, I don't see it, the outcome of it happening anytime soon because it's going to take a lot of work.
I'm Mike, I'm an addict. You know, previously I've got involved with this service thing and, you know, I'm kind of fresh in it and I heard a lot. In the past few months, I've learned a lot and I don't know like a whole lot about Jimmy Kay. And basically, you know, I feel like we should be working on today and today's service and how we can change Narcotics Anonymous today. My question would be, like, what advice would you give the fellowship today on to help the service structure, how we can get the fellowship back and hold on to it and not have all different basic texts floating around, and have like some kind of service structure, a sturdy one, you know, something better than what we've had in the past. Nothing wrong, there was nothing wrong with the past, but it's 1990, the fellowship's changed, you know, for the better, it's bigger, you know, most addicts today are clean. They're not clean and sober, you know. When I came in, I was clean and sober, you know. And today I'm clean, you know. And I've been clean quite a while. And, I don't know. You know, the people with time, I talked to them, you know, to some of them, it's like, you know, the big people up here, you know, in World Service, They like kind of like push you down and push you away. Like some of them like don't want to tell you nothing, you know. And that's the impression I get. I don't know if it's ego, pride. They want to make money. I don't know, you know. But it kind of hurts because like I'm getting all this information. I'm new in service, and some of the issues bother me, you know. Whoever started this fellowship, you know, I feel for them, you know. And I'm glad that Narcotics Anonymous is here, and I don't have to go nowhere else today. You know, and I wish the people up here in World Service Office would get honest and get real and stop playing games. You know, and that's just the way I feel.
Part of what you said struck off a chord in me, because Bo, who's going to be here tomorrow, has been, he says he has access to everything he needs for the history. He's perfectly capable of writing it. He wrote the story of the basic text. And his problem has been that he's told many people, including the World Service Office, you know, I can't do this and work a job. You know, I need someone to enable me to get this book done. No one seemed interested. So what he's been doing is slowly by slowly, you know, first he got the computer, and then he got a laser printer, and, you know, the whole time he's like, I'll just... And then he told me he was going to have to become in a financial sufficient manner to where he would be able to sit down and do it himself, if necessary. But it takes time, and, you know, he needs help, and that's part of why he offered to come here for this workshop. And he's, you know, going to Alabama as he feels that if more people become educated about the need for this, you know, nothing can be done alone. I'm very interested in the history for a lot of my own personal reasons, and I was speaking to a founder of another program who said that if the leadership is turned over to the fellowship before the fellowship is not mature enough, the disease will rip it apart. And I see that exactly happening when I look at the years and the short time with which it was taken away from Jimmy, for whatever reason. And I called up Greg and said, you know, what could have been done for that control to be kept among you longer? And he said it would have been wrong for them to do that. They had to turn it over to do spiritually the right thing. But, you know, I tend to wonder if there could not have been some way for it to be left in their control. I mean, other than Bob Stone, who's not an addict, whose bottom line is a dollar. You know, and he's got his little people. I mean, I've been there. He's got, exactly, it's parliamentary. But I'm saying during that time, you know, I want to know what could have been done to where it could have spiritually been, I want to know what could have possibly been done to spiritually turn that over like they had to do, but not to someone like Bob Stone. That's what I'd like to know. So maybe when Bob Stone's out, we don't get another one worse.
I spoke to Stu Tordman a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him about, I had a conversation with him about the recent firing of Bob Stone as the World Service Office manager of the World Service Office. And he said, and I said, well, who's going to run it now? And he said, well, it's gonna turn into, a World Service Center as opposed to a board, and it's gonna be run by, it's gonna answer more to the conference. Evidently, well, this is what he told me, okay, and he said that, the time had come where it's not that they were displeased with what he was doing, but they saw the need that the office had to be accountable to the conference, and it couldn't be run by an executive director anymore, or, you know, someone who just are, you know, the way it was. The fellowship. What I see happening, well, you know, I don't even know. You know, it's like I was raised in NA that the pyramid looked like the member in big letters at the top, you know, then the group, then the area, and as it got smaller, and then the region, and at the very bottom, the World Service Conference and the World Service Office and all the subcommittees that branched out. I see the pyramid totally turning around. And I think what's happened is we see a system of self-preservation happening, you know. Who wants to... as far as the history of the the basic text, I think Bo is very qualified to write about the history of the basic text. I don't know about the history of N.A. I've read a little bit of that. I don't really agree with it, especially about the New York stuff. I happen to know that that's incorrect. That's why I made so much references to the New York, because N.A., as we know it, did not start in New York. And as far as I'm concerned, it's one more effort to take away the credit where the credit is due. There was something else I wanted to say. I don't go to the conferences anymore from what I hear. It would totally blow me away. Some of the old timers, as someone else was saying earlier, that were there early on, yeah, they're not involved anymore. People like me, because, personally, I feel I gave 4 years of my life to that, and I'm lucky I got away from it, with my recovery, and my sanity. It was very disturbing, and until there's a totally overhaul of new people, I will not attend. I was telling somebody the other day, yeah, okay, let's all go there to the conference and say, okay, everybody can vote. The Board of Trustees, the regional reps, the World Service Office Manager, all these other frickin' subcommittees, let them all vote, people who represent absolutely no one, but under one condition, that everybody in office right now resign. And then see if they would like to have this new idea of theirs go into motion. So I don't know. It's just gotten so, the other day I was sitting at a meeting, just a regular NA meeting, and I saw the traditions up on the board, and you know how sometimes you just start glancing at them, and it just seems like what's going on is, if you really look at the traditions in just a flat, just the way they are on paper way, it seems like we've just gotten out of hand. It seems to me like we have gotten too organized. It seems to me that our service boards and committees are not directly responsible to us, It seems like we're just not following the traditions, but there's so much fancy language to justify why they are being followed that it overwhelms me, just a simple person, to get in there and strategize with these people. I think one of the reasons that the World Service Office lost out in 82 was because we were so busy sending orders out and stapling pamphlets that we didn't have time to sit around and play fucking strategy while these assholes sat around in corners talking about, okay, here's how we're going to get this motherfucker out. When this motion passes, you do this. And if that one doesn't pass, here's the plan of action. That's how it went. I saw it happening. And I think that's it's like if they don't get their way here, let's just let some time pass and we'll bring it up again. There's so many different ways, it's so professional, it's like the only people who really understand it are the people who are still sitting on these boards and committees for 10, 12 years. You send the regional rep who's in service for 1 year out there, he's sitting there overwhelmed, all he knows is his group conscience. That's all he's carrying, the thousands of people that he's representing. And you hear all this bullshit. You don't know how to think. You don't want to be left out. So then a vote is called for. It's so easy to forget why you're there. And so what do? You look around the room. Oh, there's Joe Blow trustee. Well, he must know what's happening. I'll just vote like him, So I don't really think when we talk about fellowship approved at the conference level, I don't know, because, the issues that we're talking about at home, they're not of anything they're talking about at the conference. So I wonder where is all this group conscience shit they're talking about that's happening at the world coming from? Because I really believe, my personal opinion is if all our regional reps carried just exactly what our regions want and nothing else, the conferences will go back to 3 days long because there'll be no bullshitting and no more ego playing. You have to remember that a lot of people that are also in service, these regional reps, they don't have a lot of time clean. Some of them do, some of them don't. And not all of them have finished work in the steps. So, you know, they want to be heard. They want to raise their hand. They want to talk. You know, that's normal. I think we all go through that. People tolerate us. Maybe that's the feeling that your friend there was speaking about of earlier, how it always seems that they look down to me. You know, I guess after a while you just get tired of hearing the same question year after year after year. My feeling is that the system of services should be on a rotating basis. And we should get more to the spirit of volunteerism and rotation as opposed to preserving the powerful positions that can sway many of us when it comes to money, property, and prestige. So that's... I know a lot of these people go home and pray, you know, and I know a lot of them go home and write inventory and share with the newcomer, but it's real easy to think that you're doing the right thing and not even realize that you're being motivated by perhaps something else, you know, holding on to your big fancy name or your big fancy payroll, your salary, I mean, or whatever, you know. So.
Yeah, I'm an addict named Mike, and I was just wondering what year we had started paying our trusted servants, you know, to work in the office. And what year did that take place?
The year after the
crisis. And what?
See, the profits started coming in soon.
Okay, was our fellowship aware of that? Did they have any say in how much salary we would pay them? Or was that approved by the WSO itself? And could, I just have one more question. Could you briefly tell me how that affected Narcotics Anonymous as a whole?
I think it's made a lot of people resentful. I mean, that's what I'm seeing. I think that accountability, financial accountability for every service arm of Narcotics Anonymous is essential because we're all addicts and because it's important that because we're a fellowship to know where the money's going and how it's spent. I don't know who makes what or how much they make. I don't know if that information is even available to the fellowship. Is it? Huh? Oh, great. I did ask Stu when I talked to him. I said, well, you know, I hear a lot of people are upset that so many people are flying around the world first class into countries where NA hasn't even started just to set up corporation rights. You know, what the hell's going on? And he said, well, Fawn, you should know better than that. he said that the laws are very different in other countries. For example, in Germany, when they were translating the literature, Germany has a problem with the word leaders, and they wanted to change that word. So there's a lot of stuff that I guess justifies, you know, sending people out to get the... I know I've heard translations are very, very costly, although the Spanish translation of our little white book cost nothing. We had it done by the foreign class, Spanish foreign class at the University of Southern California for free when we told them what we wanted to do. What? I don't know.
I'm Alan, an addict. You talked about the first basic text. Could you elaborate on the process they used to approve the first basic text?
Okay, your best bet to understand, to get a fair, precise picture of the new text, is when you look at the box.
Hi, Carl.
Most wonderful lady we both share in our lives, Betty. She passed along phone numbers to be in contact with you and Doug in her hopes of organizing what she's called a calamity for as long as I've known her. Maybe that's something on a personal level what we might be able to discuss later. I guess my major question, one of the things that is being voiced out to the fellowship today is a new service structure. And one of their comments transpired in 79-80 of the creation of the office as a separate entity, being in service from 78 to 82. Are you privileged to information to what actually occurred from what was available in the tree that put the office in the hands of the Board of Trustees and what is now being explained as all of a sudden it came out of the office and into production as a separate entity and nobody noticed. How close is that to the truth? Okay. The office became its own separate entity outside of control of the trustees in 79-80. That was said to have happened in the office.
Okay.
When the World Service Office staff, good question. When the World Service Office staff was working at the office at that time, there were a couple of trustees who were also part of the staff. They stopped coming to work, and they were later discovered to be the instigators of a lot of the dissension in terms of, like, we got to get him out of there, you know, and stuff like that. So the office had elections and voted in a new board. That's what happened. And it was all the people that were voted onto the board were the workers. We decided the people best qualified to be participants of the World Service Office were the people, I mean, to be on the board of the World Service Office, were the people who were doing the damn work. Because everyone else had so many opinions, you know, you'd always get these people coming over with their big, grandiose ideas, and then they'd split. You know, they didn't want to hang around and help out with the work. Right. Right. World Service Office, quite simply, what they presented at the conference is that, was that the World Service Office was a separate entity in that the way that they explained it, there was no... Right, and also because if NA was ever sued, NA, the fellowship could not be sued, the World Service Office would be sued. So that way it protected, it was like the legal part of the fellowship. That's the only reason that that was ever stated. It wasn't like something that was new and invented. It was always known that the World Service Office was a separate entity. It's, what they were trying to say was that the World Service Office is not Narcotics Anonymous, you know, just like a dance isn't. And it wasn't a secret agenda or something, you know, to come out with this.
can we get this NA history book, can we get it printed without anything on a world level? Can we do it privately? And, like, if that was successful, could we print something else without the world? Or, and what kind of plans are being taken to print the history?
But then there'd probably be, wouldn't there be problems with the infringement of the name Narcotics Anonymous? I mean, if you wanted to do it through the structure.
Can I ask you a question? What is Narcotics Anonymous then? I mean, isn't it the group? I mean, isn't the group Narcotics Anonymous? I mean, so how could the groups infringe upon what's rightfully theirs?
We have a service structure. If something stinks, then the service structure should be changed.
That's group of Narcotics Anonymous to change that by a group taking action and following through with it. I mean, the group is autonomous and can take action within the group and start initiating them changes and doesn't have to wait for the conference to go through the
Things should go from the fellowship to the conference, not the other way around. We should not be being told what's going to happen to us from the conference. We should be directing the conference what we want done. I was very shocked to hear, I was like the last one to know that, there was a time in NA when all the World Service Committees were open to the fellowship. You know, if you wanted to be on the literature committee, anybody could come. Now you got to be pooled and voted if you even want to be on it. I mean, I hate the closing off that I see happening, the exclusion stuff that's going on. There used to be a time when there were no time requirements. I had 6 months clean. I was the secretary of conference. I mean, it's just gotten so to a point where I think it would turn a lot of people off to even bother trying to get on some of these committees because it's such a hassle and so hard to get signed up on the list or get your name. I don't know how they do it now, but I know it's not the way they used to do it. Because basic text created by the fellowship, you know. I don't see why that can't still be happening. And I'm shocked at this whole thing about the 12 principles of service. I think that's so horrible because it's not the NA I know, you know, and that really blows me away, you know.